There we go. Well, good evening, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. Here I am again. It seems like I was just here a little while ago. I want to thank Peter for... I'm glad that you let him participate in this. And he drove me up, but he's been a big... I spent a lot of time in the hospital last year. I was researching ambulances. See who provided the best service. And he was around to help me with a lot of things that I'm really grateful for. So thank you, Peter. And I'm so glad to see Dick and Barbara A. that came over. Been around a lot of years. You make a lot of friends that... you enjoy, oh boy. Woo. The second half of this talk is going to be something. So anyway, Dick and Barb, it's so good to see you, and I've missed all you people. Yeah, last year was just one of those challenges, and just a lot of emergencies and pain and surgeries and this and that. And the reason I'm bringing it up is I thought, this is an example of spiritual arrogance. I thought that my spiritual connection was so strong nothing could break it. And so they challenged me last year with pain and lack of energy and going down and down and down. And it did break. It just got, I was suddenly Mr. Self-Centered, whining complainer. And I felt insulted. I said, how could this have happened to me? Of all the people. That's nothing but arrogance, thinking that nothing can penetrate. So I learned a good lesson last year. I appreciate it, God, but let's pick on somebody else next year as I slowly reestablish contact. I forgot how painful self-centeredness is. Oh. I was thinking about what type of talk to give tonight, and I haven't made my mind up yet, so it's going to be a potpourri of things, you know, a lot about AA and a little bit about my story, which when you've told it as many times as I have, it really gets boring. It's just, maybe I'll tell Dick's story. My great-grandfather was head of the Confederate Army or whatever. Oh, I got it wrong. Oh, my God. Anyway, this is what I was thinking about to get started. When you look at AA, and if there are new people here, I really recommend that you spend some time learning the history of AA. It will add to your program immeasurably as you study how this thing got started, and the various people that played big roles, and so on down. And when you study it, you find out that there's no answer to how did AA come into being. There's only one answer. It just happened. There was no plan. There was nothing. It just happened. That's amazing. When I see that, I see God's hand all over this. And I see that all the thousands of years that alcoholics had no hope. And they would just be the outcast. There wasn't a thing that could be done. And all of a sudden, this appears. this fellowship just appears. And whenever I think about it, I think about, you know, it's not here, and then it's here. It just appears. And it reminds me of the universe. It wasn't here, and then, boom, there's a big bang. And nobody can explain that, but that happened, and then everything else unfolded from there. And I think, you know, history people in this room would probably divide into three groups as to what AA's Big Bang was. There'd be a certain percentage maybe over here who thought it was when Evie came to see Bill. And then there'd be another crowd that said, no, it was when Bill was pacing in the Mayflower Hotel, and he thought he better find another alcoholic, and found Dr. Bob. I'm in the third camp, who thinks it was the spiritual experience in Towns Hospital. And the reason I'm bringing it up, Bill said a prayer out of desperation in Towns Hospital, and I call this for myself the prayer that started AA. And for those of you that are new that don't like any dogmatic religion, wait till you hear this prayer. This is how it starts. If there is a God, how do you like that beginning? That comes from a desperate person. If there is a God, please show himself to me. And in Bill's case, he had a very amazing experience where he saw lights and felt wind on the top of a mountain, and it lasted for who knows how many seconds or minutes. And when it finished, he knew that he would never have to drink again. The obsession, compulsion, all that was gone. And so he called the doctor, Silkworth, to come in because he didn't know if he had gone crazy or if he really had such an experience. And Dr. Silkworth said to him, after looking at him, he said, I would go with that, Bill. He says, you're a different person. Now, I can think of a lot of other doctors who would have said, don't pay attention to it. It's the medicine I had you on. So disregard that. And that didn't happen. He said to go with it, believe it. And contained in that experience was not only the freedom from alcohol, but it appeared to Bill that he had just been shown the way out for all the alcoholics in the world. And that his job, starting in that moment, he's still in the hospital, was to pass this on to all the alcoholics in the world. And he never stopped trying to do that. And there was a lot of bad stuff that happened in his life in terms of adversity and, you know, losing the townhouse in Brooklyn, and then he's traveling around living in 70 different AA people's houses while he's working on the program and trying to write the big book and so on down. And, you know, we talk about principles, not personalities, but by God, there's been some personalities in AA that I'm sure glad we're here. And, of course, Bill is one of them. I've just come to, the more I study about him, and we've been doing a lot of history studying. We're reading, I think the best history book is Not God by Ernest Kurtz. If you're not familiar with it, it's he was a Harvard student. He wanted to do a PhD on AA. Can you imagine that, a PhD on AA? And Harvard approved it, so he went to New York and said, can I have access to everything? And they said yes. And so he had access. So it's the only history that I consider kind of official that wasn't written by AA itself. You know, when you write your own history, sometimes you leave out some of the less flattering things that happened. And so anyway, this is, I really have appreciated Bill Wilson by studying the amazing things that happened. And I wasn't interested in history. I didn't ever take history in school. I remember it's in prep school, somebody said, why don't you take another history class? I said, well, I don't want to study that. It already happened. I don't want to. Is that a pretty stupid statement? It already happened. What the hell do I want to study that for? So, because of that attitude and because I was flat broke, I never met Bill Wilson. Now, I'm in Washington, D.C., and every year my friends would go, we're going up to the Bill Wilson dinner. You ought to go up and meet him because someday you're going to regret that you didn't go. I said, well, why do I want to meet Bill Wilson? What the hell is that? That's no. I need money. I'm really desperate, and I had six kids, and we were broke as can be, and, you know, I'm shaking, newly sober and everything. So for 7 years, I didn't go to New York to meet Bill. If I had gone and had a picture of Bill and I would have it here on the podium. I wouldn't mention it. It would just be there in case you happened to observe it. But I did meet Lois, so I and Chuck C. And we've all met people that we, as time goes on, we realize, boy, they were the rock of my area or my home group or my favorite convention, and whenever they were there, and I remember the first time I heard Clancy up in Washington, D.C., I just loved it. And the reason I loved him so much was he was the first one that taught me through example that the only way to communicate spirituality is through stories. You can't talk directly about God or spiritual awakening. You have to make up. Well, it's kind of like a, and Clancy had that invisible boat story. I don't know if you remember. That goes all the way back to the 60s. The AA boat that was invisible, and if you don't row, it won't become visible and all these stuff. And so over the years that I've followed his model, and it was just a great example. And Dick, you said he just had a heart thing, a stent put in, and he'll be traveling here to something. The prepaid?
This weekend in Jekyll.
Oh, the Jekyll. Okay. So anyway, I'm rambling about some of the giants that influenced me. And if you're new, you want to be influenced. You want something to affect you in that way so that you can start to have faith and start to really believe in this other world, this spiritual world that AA talks about and our literature talks about. But when we're new, we hear it talked about, but we don't see it. And so we have to be observant, and we have to look around, because I had something happen and early in my sobriety, and it was about 3 months later that I fully appreciated it. And what happened was I had about 2 months. I'm going to a meeting, and a new guy comes in, and he's a little bit late, and he goes over to the coffee thing. He sees the coffee thing over there. And his hands are shaking so bad, he can't get the thing to work, you know what I mean? And so he finally puts it down and goes over and sits down without the coffee. And I'm watching this because I shook almost that bad, and I'm kind of relating with him and suffering the embarrassment that I felt he must be suffering, etc. And for some unknown reason, during the week, I wondered how he was. I hadn't wondered how anybody was in years. I didn't know his name. I didn't know anything about it. And when the meeting came the next week, I was actually looking around to see if he was there, which, again, is very strange behavior for me. And about 10 minutes into the meeting, he came in and he was late. And he went back to that coffee thing and started the shake bit. And he got about a half a cup. And then he took the half a cup and with both hands, he made his way over to the table. And when he put the cup down at the table, I saw him breathe a big sigh of relief. And I felt myself going, yay! And I think a couple months later, I realized what had happened. I felt joy for someone else's progress. I don't remember feeling that. It was almost such a new experience. And so even if you're new, there's people newer than you. And if you keep your eye on them, you might find little moments of joy coming in as you see them stop trembling when they talk, or if you see them actually raise their hand and do something. And that's the beginning of our sharing the good news that exists here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so, I don't know about you, but when they would have promotion parties at work and Alice was getting promoted, you don't think I was there happy that she got promoted. I'm going, the hell is she getting promoted? I do better work than she does. It's a freaking place. It's unfair. It's been unfair for the last thing. And I just walk out and go to the nearest bar and go, screw you, Alice. I mean, I was not thrilled with somebody else's well-being because there's only so much to go around. So if she got it, that's less for me. It's the way I looked at everything. The other thing about AA that I was reflecting on was when Bill died. Up until that time, boy, it's a good thing he lived that long to get AA on track the way it is, because he possessed, when you look at his writings and letters and grapevine things, he was dealing with problems of all kinds of stuff going on in AA all over the country, and somehow he found the words to offer counsel without offending anyone. He just had a way of asking the person, well, maybe look at the other side of this, try what you try, considering this. It was just amazing. And he knew, since Dr. Bob had already passed away in 1950, that what was going to happen to this, probably back then there was 400,000 sober AA members who couldn't agree on what kind of coffee to get in their home group. How was AA going to stay together? I mean, boy, well, you know, we can get argue at a drop of a hat over something. You hear what they're doing in Texas? Well, man. And, you know, when you look at the service manual, he took spirituality into an organizational chart. I mean, he brought God into the organizational structure of this fellowship. And as long as God remains the centerpiece of both our meetings and our service structure, we're going to be in good shape. We're going to be in great shape. But it has to stay there. It's real easy for the human egos, once you get a bureaucracy, for the human egos to start thinking they know better, and I think we ought to do this and that. And we were talking about the CCAD. Does anybody remember CCAD here in Atlanta, the Southeast Conference on Alcohol and Drug Abuse, and Dr. Hunter and put that on? This is what it reminds me of. Conway had this idea that it was possible to have a spiritual medical conference where you would get the PhDs and doctors with all the expertise about the disease of alcoholism and allow them to give their talks and present their papers and then interject spirituality along the way, which sing the Lord's Prayer, that have little breakout sessions, and then that have a big Saturday night deal with tuxedos, and the AA talk would be the top billing of the weekend. And this last set, it started out, it looked like everybody was really happy with it. But as the years went on, you could tell that the doctors didn't like playing second place to God. You could just see it. You know, I wrote this paper. This should be the star of the weekend. It's this thing. I just had this breakthrough in the brain, whatever it was. So I forget how many years it was, but about 10 years. They got together and gave Conway a gold Mercedes and phased him out. And the next year, the AA meeting was in the basement. Now, the reason I'm saying that is, sometimes in the middle of what we might call business, it's hard to keep God in the middle of it. And that is what I think is absolutely necessary to have things turn out for the best welfare of Alcoholics Anonymous. Even in the home group, if we're going to have a business meeting, let's have a prayer and then start it. So those are just some, it's been preying on my mind because Bill's been gone so many years and there's never going to be anybody take his place. And so it's going to be up to all of us to watch and be guardians ourselves of that central force, which is the higher power. And so I'm really big on primary purpose and a higher power. I just like to say one problem, one solution, alcoholism and God. That's as simple as it can be. So let's see, what else can I give a speech on? Oh, in this history book, when he covered the period from 1971 to 1987, people asked him how long he thought AA would last. That was an interesting question to ask a historian. You've been studying this fellowship for 15 years. And writing, and I mean, the footnotes in this book take up half the book. It's a, you know, when you, so it's a guy who has really studied it. And he said, well, there's two forces that could hurt AA. And of course, it's the right and the left. It's the dogmatic, there's only one way. We got to go back to 1940 and get those pages where they typed up exactly how you talk to a pigeon about the first step. You say these words. So that would be the dogmatic. Equally dangerous would be anything goes. You want to start a meeting where we just study bat wings? Fine. We ought to allow that. Bats fly and we used to fly high drinking. And so it's just interesting, isn't it, that we're a society like other societies are. I like to think of AA as a society. And I just think that a lot of vigilance is necessary to keep us in the center. And if you've been around a while, I think you know what I'm talking about. And it just, We have a tendency to not speak up. I've noticed that a lot. Where I should have said this. I should have pointed out. I should have. And so I adopted a policy some years ago that if something was said at a meeting that was so out of line, that I would talk to the person the next day. I would let a whole day go by so that it didn't look like it was directly in response. And then I'd say, I'd like to give you some thoughts on whatever it is. And then a couple weeks later, I would bring it up during the meeting as just an afterthought. You know, I was thinking about this and that, so that it never really looked like it was in opposition to something that somebody did. And it just, in other words, the temperatures have cooled, it's sat down, and people are more open-minded then. I was thinking about a situation where you could have this or you could have that. And it seems to work pretty well, so I'll just throw that out. Anyway, I was born in Connecticut. And when I was born, AA hadn't started yet. I had one sister, Sue, that was 3 years younger than I am, and she ended up in AA, and it shocked me because she wasn't anything like me. You know what I mean? I didn't even know she drank, quite frankly, because she did all her drinking after I had left and joined the Marine Corps and wasn't around home. And even after she joined AA, I hadn't heard her story. So I just said, well, God, she never got in trouble. She never did this and that. So anyway, she came down to Tampa, and I asked her to talk at a group. And when she got through talking, I went, that's my sister. It was so cool. She's hiding her alcoholism from her husband. So she's got the vodka bottle in the bed. I mean, you know, he's seeing all this, but she thinks she's fooling him. And in case the bottle got empty, she had another one in the trash can just outside the garage door. And I'm going, yeah, I'm relating. I think we have a real alcoholic here. And she woke up one night and the bottle in the bed was empty. So she was going to have to go get a drink from the bottle outside without waking her husband. So she's tippy-toeing. You can imagine how much noise we're making. We're tippy-toeing out of the bed, down the stairs, into the garage, and they had the doors that make noise, the roll-up doors. So she had to raise it a quarter of an inch at a time. You know what I mean? So that it... Nobody's going to hear me out in the garage. Boy, am I clever. Boy, I am really good. She gets the door open and goes over to the trash can. There's the bottle of vodka. One. Is that enough? Wait a minute. Let me think. Got to make sure. Got to go to sleep. One more. Puts the top back on. Puts it in. Puts it down. Goes in. She gets the door all the way down and says, I didn't get enough. And I heard her, and I just went, wow. See, you don't have to be out getting in bar fights or anything. When she told that story, I just went, man, is that alcoholism at its finest? At its finest. And so she had, 32 years when she passed away in AA. And once she joined, if you ever have a brother or sister or close relative join AA, you become like this. You may have been close before, but once she joined, I had two daughters join, and that just changed everything. The second they became members, we had our own language, and we just communicated differently, and so it made a whole wonderful relationship. I think the biggest thing I remember is that I didn't belong. That's what everybody else in AA had the feeling. And I was very afraid of something. I didn't know what it was. And there was a set of rules of some kind that existed inside of my head that I was supposed to live up to, but couldn't. Nobody put them there. They just were there. Later on, I read C.S. Lewis, Mere Christianity, and there he is. He's talking about the moral law that sits inside of us. Nobody knows how it got there, and we can't live up to it. Well, it becomes an impasse for human beings, and the only way to live up to it is to seek God. And so I was, and also the church encouraged guilt. So I already had some, and then I added on what was expected from the church, was try to feel guilty most of the time, and then you're, we'd consider you a good Catholic if you are guilty most of the time. So I felt guilty most of the time and did things to make myself feel guilty. What time did we start? 20 of 9, roughly? Okay. I don't like to go over. So I found no comfort in the idea of God. I believed it. I read everything about in the Bible and all that, but I found no comfort in it because I saw, as many kids did, that he was out to get me. I had no chance of ever behaving myself to a level that I would be welcome. My sister, on the other hand, felt comfortable and loved, just could hardly wait to walk in that church. So as soon as I got old enough, I just stopped going. But I never forgot about it. I mean, it was always plaguing me in the back of my mind, no matter, you can't really get rid of that kind of stuff. And I grew up in New Haven. I went to a little prep school outside, and it fed right into Yale University. I had worked on their buildings in construction. My father worked there. It was like a hometown place. So I never gave it much thought that it was special. And then when I got there, and then all these people in the freshman class, I recognized them from newspapers and magazines and stuff, and I'm going, geez, who the hell, what am I doing with these guys? I mean, they were in a different league. And I just didn't feel that I belonged there, and I also decided not to drink. Something inside of me said, you don't want to be drinking. That could really be bad. But there's a lot of pressure in college to drink, and so at a social event where I was supposed to meet a bunch of people, I was unable to walk up and shake anybody's hand because I looked in their eyes, and they were looking like, I don't want to know you. Do you get it? And I went, okay, yeah, geez, don't worry. So I went over, and there was a bartender there, so I had 2.5 drinks. Nothing was happening, and I decided to leave. I said, I guess the alcohol doesn't work that well. And I've said this in every talk. I turned around to walk out, and everyone in the room wanted to know me. They were all looking at me. Would you join our group? I'd love to be your friend. And I just went, God, this is amazing. And so I ran around and shook everybody's hand. I had something to say to everybody. Hey, how you doing? Where are you from? Where are you? I'd never done that before in my life with strangers. Just, hey, it didn't matter who the hell they were. I was just as good as they were. And then they started leaving, and I remember I said this for the rest of my drinking career. Where are you going? Right? Then you all said, hey, where are you going? We're just getting started here. Pretty soon they're all gone. So I went back to the bar and I said, boy, if 3 drinks did that, I wonder what 20 would do. And so I did all that and got it out of the way and found out how sick you can get. And that next morning, I thought I was going to die. And the thought occurred to me, are you going to drink again tonight? And it was like a millionth of a second. Of course I am. I said, this dying and puking is a small price to pay for what I had last night. That's why I'm an alcoholic. Because what alcohol did for me, it doesn't do for non-alcoholics. It does not give them a spiritual experience and solve every problem they have so that they would be willing to throw up blood for a couple of years just to keep drinking. So when they don't understand us, it's because alcohol doesn't give them what it gives us. And so that set me up where alcohol is the number one thing in my life. The grades disappeared, athletics, the whole thing, and I barely graduated, and the Korean War was, draft was on, so we joined the Marine Corps, a bunch of us. And at first I thought I'd made a horrible mistake. They really have a way of greeting you that's not pleasant, would be the best way of... But after a while I fell in love with it, and Dick just brought me another Marine hat, and I really appreciate it. And I decided after seeing a training film about pilots that I would sign up for flight school even though I hadn't been ever in an airplane. I met this wonderful woman. We got married, went on our honeymoon to New York, and then flew down to Atlanta and then to Pensacola, Florida, and I got airsick on the commercial planes. And also in the old SNJ. But the motion sickness went away and I started doing real good. And I said, man, this is it. And I decided then, as soon as I got through 18 months of flight school, I'm staying in here. I'm going to make this a career. I loved all the people, and, you know, planes are fun. And so that was what I set out to do. And we got transferred around to different duty stations, and we ended up with 6 children. And I got promoted to first lieutenant, and then I got promoted to captain, and I did a tour with the... 1st Marine Division, which in Pendleton, which was an honor to be a forward air controller in one of their battalions, and to just realize that every supporting thing in the Marine Corps, whether you're artillery, supply, pilots, whatever it is there to make the infantry guy's job easier. He's the man. He's the top guy in the Marine Corps, is the infantry soldier. Infantry Marine. And so I just loved that tour with them. And my drinking was progressing, and I would get in trouble once in a while. You know, I'd be late, I'd miss this. And back then there was sort of a thing, well, if I like him, I'm going to not report him. They're real chicken today. They report everybody for everything, so... They don't like drunks, you know, happy hours and all that stuff. I understand it's just terrible. You have to sneak off and become an alcoholic on your own. Whereas I remember drinking as a unit. The colonel ordered the drinks, and we're all sitting there, and you know, boy, those were great days. But as the time went on, I started getting some serious trouble. I mean, I missed a ship one time. We were in Taiwan on maneuvers, and we had flown over, but I did something wrong, and they said, you're going back on the ship with the troops. So I had my duffel bag, put it in the ship, and the captain of the ship said, Liberty goes until 5 a.m., and a.m. had just come over the PA system, and I was already down the gangplank and gone, and the captain went to the officer of the day and said, no, there's no liberty at all. So he went, cancel that, and only 2 guys got off, me and 1 other guy, and the other guy was still on the dock, and they got him. So the ship left 2 hours earlier than had been scheduled. So when I arrived at 5 a.m., hungover, broke, and there's no chance. I said to the taxi driver, is this Pier 56? Yes, sir. But, you know, there's a tough problem. What are you going to do, man? You're in Taiwan. Fortunately, I still had enough money for a few drinks. And once you can put some drinks in, then the answers start coming. So I took the cab back to the base we were at, which was the Chinese Air Force Academy. And they had dogs patrolling and everything, but I knew they were every 10 minutes or something. So I went back and snuck through the fences back into the base and then went back to where we were staging out with the airplanes. They're still packing and loading them up. And I just kind of walked up like I was, can I give you a hand with that?
Yeah.
And I would have got away with it almost completely, except some major came up and said, aren't you supposed to be on the ship? And I said, yes, sir, this is a long story, listen to that. So I ended up flying back. And they were able to verify that the captain did say Liberty went, but I would have been in the brig for a long time on something like that. But it's just, every time us alcoholics pull a stunt like that and get away with it, we feel more superior, more bulletproof, more anything. And I remember the last one that I worked on was in flying. I started to get withdrawal symptoms in the airplanes because I wouldn't drink for 10 hours. Big mistake when you're in advanced alcoholism. You should take alcohol with you in the plane so you don't have a seizure or something. And so I was flying and these attacks would come. And I would feel something awful is going to happen. My heart would start racing, and then I wouldn't be able to see that well, and I would be sweating. And it wouldn't happen all the time, but it started happening fairly regularly. And I've mentioned this before. I came up with, it was a photo plane that I was flying. It was during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And all the photo stuff is on the stick, the cameras. And so you could fly the mission with one hand, and then I had one hand on the ejection seat. And my theory was that if I did lose it, I would pull the curtain and I would go out. The chute opens automatically at 10,000 feet. The plane crashes. I'm fine. Problem solved. It was just like, you know what I mean? They almost had me. But when you're smarter than the average mouse, you just come up with... Anyway, that got so bad that there was four of us, and I declared an oxygen emergency. I was going to jump out of this plane, but it was a two-seater, and the guy on the right didn't know how to fly. So I declared an oxygen emergency, and the flight leader, if you do that, you have to land because you could be passing out due to lack of oxygen. He saw an Air Force base nearby. We landed, and I went over to the officers' club and got a couple drinks, and I started thinking about, God, that was awful. I almost jumped out of that thing because I couldn't stay where I was. We went down the flight line, and the maintenance people said, there's nothing wrong with the oxygen. And I looked at the flight leader, and all of a sudden, it was like alcohol put these words in my mouth. I said, I'm not going to fly anymore. Now, this is my love. This is my whole life. I've been doing it for 14 years. And he said, what? I said, I'm not going to fly anymore. Why? I'm just not going to fly anymore. So somebody else flew the plane back. And I don't remember how it was done or whatever, but I had to go see the colonel. And he said, what's this, Sandy? You're not going to fly anymore? I said, yes, sir, I'm not. Why? I'm just not going to fly anymore. I wouldn't say anything else. I never amplified on it. I just insisted, and I would just take my name. I'd scratch my name off the flight schedule. So he finally had to take action and get me a new job in the Marine Corps, which took about 3 months for the commandant to give me a new specialty, which turned out to be air traffic controller. How do you like that? In the meantime, I did all the legal work for the squadron, and I swear I would not make eye contact with any of the pilots because I was so ashamed. I knew they were looking and just going, wow, how did we get that dirtbag in our outfit? I could just feel it. And at the end of 3 months, I finally left there, and I went along being an air traffic controller, but I was in charge, so I never talked to any airplanes. The enlisted men, when I went overseas, they said, Captain, you just sit and drink your coffee and we'll do all the controlling. Please don't talk to any airplanes. They saw what kind of shape I was in. And I lost about 40 pounds due to malnutrition during that 14-month tour. And when I came back, I had a grand mal seizure, ended up in the nut ward for 6 months, and AA came in, and that's how I got in there, got into AA. And this story just happened a few years ago. I was in California at the Brentwood Group. California has a lot of big meetings. You know, they had 500 people at their beginners meeting every week. And it's an interesting format in that they get an old-timer to go up and talk on a topic, a little bit of his story or her story, and then the people raise their hand and ask questions. And Chuck Chamberlain used to go there a lot. And just think how great that would be to be able to raise your hand and ask Chuck something you've always wanted to know about something. And a lady was getting her 32-year medallion. And she was driving up, and her husband was not in AA, but he went with her to all these things. But he was just going to get coffee that night. And she told him there was a guy, a Marine pilot, that was, he said, "What's his name?" He said, "Sandy." He said, "I think I know him. Tell him to come out here." So I went out, never saw this guy in my life. And he said to me, "In 1962, you were in a flight of four F-3Ds, radar planes. You declared an oxygen emergency, and you never... and you never flew again." And I went, "How the hell do you know that?" And he said, "I was in the plane with you." So, what are the odds on that? And I said, "You were? Wow." Because I was very confused about everything. And he wasn't a radar guy. He was another pilot who had been recalled from American Airlines for the Cuban Missile Crisis. And there was a hurricane coming to Cherry Point, and when hurricanes come to air bases, the pilots, the brave pilots, fly the planes to somewhere safe, and the families worry about the hurricane, so you can see. So the hurricane was over, and we were flying back. And so that's why we didn't have any radar guys. It was all pilots, because all we did was drink until the hurricane went away. And so he started filling me in on what was going on and all of that. And the next day he came up to Oxnard and he brought his photo album from back then. And all of a sudden I went, "Oh yeah, I remember him." And I, you know, because I was all foggy about that. And anyway, he got through and he said, "Did you have any idea how popular you were in that squadron?" That was the first I heard of that. And he said, "It was breaking the colonel's heart that he couldn't figure out how to help you." And all the guys, we were calling people, we were doing this, and there was no alcohol. The Navy didn't have the disease of alcoholism, so nobody could have it. And no one had heard of AA, at least in that little crowd. And so they were going, how can we help them? And we give all this stuff. And he said, "When you left, we were so sad. It just hurt us deeply." And I said, "Wow, that's not how I remember it." So I had to go back 42 years and change my past and substitute the truth for my perception of what happened. I went back and changed my past. You don't think the past can be changed. It happens all the time. We have our ideas of what happened, which are generally really screwed up. But they're punishing us. I always felt shame whenever I thought about that. It was just like a whip. I would just casually think about that incident, and I would just feel sweat on my forehead. Now I think about it and I go, "God, that's amazing what those guys are trying to do." I almost have a smile on my face. This is what AA does if you're new. Old ideas. That was an old idea that no one liked me and they were disgusted with me. And it was availing me a lot of suffering. And our whole program is designed to go in and inventory all of our ideas and get rid of the ones that are wrong. And they're serving no purpose. I think I said this morning in the workshop that Chuck Chamberlain's favorite thing was to find out he was wrong about something so he could get rid of it. We get rid of these ideas. And that's why it seems like our family straightens out and the world straightens out and all these things straighten out. Because of the nature of our steps, they're miraculous. If you're new, you just have to trust that this is going to produce the results that the other people are telling you about. If you're new, you only have to, you need a sponsor, and you need just to ask one question: what do I do next? And then do it. So you see, you're relieved of all responsibility of figuring out what to do. This is a piece of cake program. You just follow the next suggestion. And then you go, well, what's my job? Don't I have any job in this? Yes. Your job is to evaluate the results. Every 3 months, sit down and is it going better than when I was in charge? Or is it going worse? And you will find that it consistently gets better, that you are more relaxed, you're sleeping better, you're getting along with people better. Your life has been transformed by following guidance, not by thinking it up yourself. And the ultimate guidance comes from our higher power. And this is, I think it's just the ultimate jackpot in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a book called Brother Lawrence, Practicing the Presence. It's probably 600 years old. It's a little skinny book. And this, he was not educated enough to be a friar or whatever you call it, so he was just a brother. And his job was shining shoes and cooking breakfast in a friary or whatever it was. But he was the most spiritual of all. And the others would write him with problems, and he would give them advice. And he kept it down to the simplest terms. He tried to be in contact with God all the time. That was what he was saying, practicing the presence. He just thought about, no matter what he was doing, he kept his mind on the fact that he had a higher power, and that higher power was here. And isn't it wonderful to have this higher power? You want your shoes shined? Okay, isn't it wonderful to have it? And just had this. And I remember this one little sentence. Anytime you get real spiritual, you end up with pure simplicity. And I tell people that I sponsor and other people, if you really want to work on that, when you make a comment at a discussion meeting and you finish, you'll realize that you probably, if you're an average person, you said 10 to 15 sentences, and then that finished your comments on surrender. So the next time, try to reduce it to 7 sentences. Your own comments, reduce them to 7. And the next time, reduce them to 3. And see if you can eventually, when it's your turn, you just say one sentence and it covers everything that it used to take you 7 minutes to cover. And just to induce people to try that, it's called spiritually showing off. Do you ever notice when Alice shares, she just talks for a minute and then she seems to say it all in a minute, and the absolute simplicity. And so the sentence I remember out of Brother Lawrence was, he says, whenever I think about God, I feel real humble because he's God and I'm not. And I just went, that captures it all. It captures it all. What alcoholics have to do to start with is they have to stop playing God. And that's very hard since you've been doing it all your life. I'm the final decider. I judge. I look around and judge who's guilty and who's innocent and who's who did it wrong. Yeah, my cousin did it wrong. My sister's wrong. All that judging and all this. And most spiritual growth involves stopping doing something. You don't get anything, you get rid of things. You just get rid of. And it's like a balloon. You throw more weight off and you go up higher. You just keep getting rid of, getting rid of. And the view keeps getting better. And there's no explaining it. You just experience it. You got to remember there's no explaining AA. Remember I was talking about that? There's no explaining the steps. You can't explain them to your friend. They go, why are you so happy? Well, I go to meetings and we work the steps. Well, what do you do at the meeting? Oh, we go in, there's 20 of us, and the leader gets up, they have a topic like resentment, and then we go all around the room and each person talks about it. Then we say the Lord's Prayer. It's so wonderful. You want to come? And they go, what? Are you freaking crazy? That makes you happy? Now, if they did come, they would understand it because they would experience it and they would see how happy people were and they would experience it, but they can't understand it. So God and spirituality isn't something to be understood, it's something to have happen. And that's what I hope on behalf of those of you that are new. I hope this year you have more happenings than you can imagine, and that you are absolutely bewildered on how to explain why you're happy. Now, there's a new problem. And if you're a good self-centered alcoholic, you'll lose sleep over it. What's your big problem? I'm trying to figure out why I'm so happy. It's really bugging me. Because we can find a way to ruin everything. Anyway, I think I've run out of time. I want to thank everybody for inviting me up, and it's been a pleasure to be part of your weekend. Thank you all very much.